Henry Mancini. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun, welcoming you to 189th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 188 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com, and you can find that under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you will also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world. Articles are relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, and especially opinion. Try it and subscribe. Once again, only one email per day, www.johnmack13.com. But I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at Sunday p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings live, or as most you listen to it later. Next week, my guest will be a frequent participant on the show, John Charles Chicdunnie, co-author with ex-New York Daily News columnist Joanne Malloy of the just-published The Greatest Beer Run Ever, a true story of friendships stronger than war. Some of Chick's co-conspirators on the show will also join us. Now to this week's show, the 189th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that is 646-716-9756. I normally hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is three-time Emmy winner and New York City TV and radio personality Lynn White. Good evening, Lynn. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, or should I say bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Vive la France.
Yes. They held with the old guard and the right wing person lost and conceded already.
Exactly. I say it's a wonderful day for democracy worldwide.
So let's start right at the beginning. Where'd you grow up, then go to early school?
I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, and I went to Edgemont School there, and I went to Montclair High School, where I was also a cheerleader, and then I went to college in Boston at Simmons College, studying communications.
Do you remember what your first aspirations were growing up?
I wanted to be a lawyer, but my father said I wasn't tough enough. And I should do something else instead. So I was at home, and I was watching TV, and I saw a report on ABC Channel 7 where there was a mental institution that was being investigated by, of all people, Geraldo Rivera.
And, the Willowbrook.
Yes, the Willowbrook.
Right.
And I thought, wow, he's an advocate. That's what I want to be. I want to be a TV news person. I can do the same thing there that I could do in a courtroom, speak up for people who really are powerless. And that's where my aspiration began.
Montclair is a suburb of New York City for the nationwide audience. Did you spend much time in NYC while you were young?
I did, because it was sort of our backyard. So we would drive into the city, we being my mother and I, my brother, my father, friends, regularly. The 66 bus went back and forth from Montclair to the city. I was on it many, many, many times. And this is kind of the cultural center, I think, of the East Coast. So we were always here going to Broadway plays, to concerts. I took dance lessons in the city and had friends here. It was just our backyard.
You mentioned Simmons. How did you happen to choose that rather than some of of the local schools or the Ivy Leagues or the New York schools?
Well, I had a friend who went to Simmons a year before I did, and she talked the school up to me, and I went up to see it and thought it was great. It was an all-girls school, and that to me didn't really matter because I was in Boston where there were several colleges, and that's kind of where I wanted to be. I applied to Yale, and I didn't get in, so I went to Simmons, and it was great. It was really a wonderful time, and it was a place to get another piece of culture, the Boston culture, and the education there was terrific, and I'm very appreciative of the fact that I was able to do that.
How about those socks? My mother was a townie from Charleston, and whenever I didn't realize it too much later, but whenever we would cross the Massachusetts line, we did a bunch of consulting there, and my wife was at Tufts for a year in an administrative position. I would revert to the Massachusetts accent and be parking the car and having some chowder. You'd be driving my wife crazy.
The car in the parking lot.
Right, in the Harvard garage.
Exactly. In fact, that's where my career got started. I had a show on a Cambridge station called WCAS where the Lone Ranger was often played. And mine was a show for the community. And I was able to interview people and talk on the air. And I was about, I guess I was a junior in college. So it was a great experience for me. And I just caught that bug to be on TV from being on the radio. And that's what I really wanted to do once I graduated.
What was your major and what was the name of the show?
The Cambridge Black Experience was the name of the show. My major was communications. I had a minor in psychology, which I really needed interviewing some of the people that I've interviewed in this lifetime and going through some of the experiences you go through as a broadcaster. And I, you know, to me, the real education, yes, you can get books, you can read books, you can learn from books, but experience is the educator of all. And to be able to have the experience while in school was, I think, a treasure.
You mentioned the Cambridge Black Experience. We recently heard the real dust-up around Fenway Park from Adam Jones. And the Yankee C.C. Sabathia said that that Fenway Park is the only place that he's ever heard racist attacks on him. And then years ago, he had that whole Roxbury brouhaha. What was it like when you were there?
Oh, it was very much the same. I don't think that there has been progress, but obviously not enough progress. I think 8 years also of our first black president has created more division in this country than ever before. And I want to say something about, you know, it happening in Fenway Park. It's not just there. I mean, you're a New Yorker. I'm sure you've been to Shea Stadium or Yankee Stadium. A story that I will tell you. There was a player who was a Met. His name was George Foster. He was black.
Sure.
He came from Cincinnati, and he was a home run hitter there. When he came to New York, he bombed. And my husband at the time and I became friendly with him and his wife, and I became their first child's godmother. And we would go and sit in the stands, and he would get up to bat. And when he would strike out, you would hear the N-word shouted all over the place. This is Shea Stadium, New York City. It happens everywhere.
I remember reading a whole bunch about that, and a lot of people seem to I'm sure some was racist, but it was racist that Mookie Wilson, for instance, didn't face, or Cleon Jones, and in some ways, some of the non-racist stuff was similar to what Jay Bruce felt last year, that the guy was expected to be the home run hitter, the power guy, and it didn't work out due to either
right.
his age or due to him being unable to adapt to New York. And as soon as you find some reason why this guy's not doing it, then it's very easy for the racist to come out. Perhaps if he had been Cleon Jones, though, and he hit 323, they never would have come out. People
exactly.
Fall back on that. Did you read?
Which is sad, isn't it?
Did you read The Boys Summer by Roger Kahn?
No, I didn't.
It was about the Brooklyn Dodgers in the glory years,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that pointed out to me how that people can damn a whole group, but individuals they like. Billy Cox, who was a tremendous fielding third baseman, went to he was in spring training and he talked to Roger Kahn and he was down. And Roger Kahn said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Oh, they're going to give that nigga my job." And he said, "What do you mean?" Because
yeah.
they're moving Jackie Robinson to third base. He said, "You mean Jackie?"
Right.
No, not Jackie. Jackie's fine.
Yeah,
fine.
Yeah,
that,
he was hitting.
That kid, Junior Gilliam. And they were moving Robinson to third to make room for Junior Gilliam. And Junior
mm-hmm.
Gilliam was part of this group of blacks that he didn't know. He wasn't his friend Jackie Robinson. And
right.
And I think that sometimes to once that bad things happen, that all of a sudden that you can blame on a whole bunch of people. I grew up in an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood in Manhattan, and I was never faced with institutional racism. There were black neighborhoods and there were Jewish neighborhoods and people that they might not have felt as happy in them or as welcome, but I used to hang out at the Apollo Theater, so things like that didn't bother me. But when I went out to Oklahoma in the Army, and I found that even though people from my unit were invited to this bar that my platoon sergeant bought, that when we got there, they wouldn't serve blacks with me because the invitation didn't include them. It was just heartbreaking. It was just...
Well, that's the way so many black people have grown up. And, you know, even in my childhood in Montclair, New Jersey, I had one friend who was a very dear, close friend whose home I couldn't go to because I was black. And one time I did go there, the father came down the stairs with a baseball bat and said, "Get the nigger out of here now." I was all of about 6 or 7, and that message resonated for the rest of my life. And to this day, it changed my life. And I went home and I asked my mother, why would they do this? And my best friend from the other side of the street, Marky Travis, was there. And I told her that this person had just called me the N-word. And she said to her mother, "Mommy, what's a nigger?" And it's you don't understand the impact that kind of a thing has on a child. All of a sudden, you are different. You're other than. You don't fit in. When you're growing up, the one thing you want more than anything is to fit in with your friends, your peers. It's important to your growth. I never did. I never did. And I didn't even really relate to black kids my age because on my block, there were very few. And so when I got to high school and junior high school, it was different. And I assimilated. I kind of identified more. But it took me a while. It was very tough for me. And it wasn't just me. It was my parents as well. My mother was educated, a teacher, once came to a PTA meeting. She had a fur coat. She went to the front door with everybody else, with my dad. And whoever was at the front door said, "Oh, maids don't wear fur coats and they use the back door. Here it is." There was once when I was in first grade and I had a teacher who sent me out of the room any time that there were notices that were meant to go home to the parents to tell them of an activity after school. I never got them. My parents never got them. The only reason we found out was my same friend who lived next door got all of these notices, and her mother and my mother were very close, and she would notice every time that Marky got a notice, I did not, and my mom had to take it up with the principal. And these things are, you know, we forget that it was only in the 60s, in the 70s, that things really shifted. Before the Civil Rights Act, if you went down south and you were black, you had to use a different water fountain. You couldn't sit in a movie theater in the front. You had to sit in the balcony. My father, who lived in Illinois, had that same situation. They couldn't go to the YMCA. They couldn't swim in the pool. And it's just, you think about these things happening in other places, in the apartheid part of South Africa in the day, but it was right here as well.
Yeah, in some cases, it's only recently that I think I always appreciated, particularly after this thing in Oklahoma, it was 1962, and we did very well in an inspection, and the sergeant told us that he and another sergeant had just bought a boat a mile out of Lawton, Oklahoma, which was the worst place in the world. There was a Mexican section, there was an Indian section, there was a black section, there was the white soldier section, there was a white real people section. They were all subdivided. So he invited us down to his place, this bar, and it was a mile outside of town. Now, he was smart enough to know that we weren't going to leave if we were there. But when they wouldn't serve these people, and I wound up leaving, then I couldn't say anything to him because he was over me. But 3 weeks later, I had an opportunity to when I was no longer in his unit. And I saw him in a bar, and I bought him a beer, and I explained to him. And he said, I'm so sorry that happened. I don't want people to be embarrassed. He said, but we really don't mix. And I said, what? I said, what about Sergeant Larry, who is his superior? Oh, he's a fine gentleman, and he's a good soldier. Oh, would you have a drink with him? Oh, yes, I have in the NCO club. He's good company. Oh, would you have him to your house? And then all of a sudden he looks at me and says, I have a wife and a daughter. And I had no idea how to answer that. I said, as though he thought that all black men had to expose themselves to white women. And I couldn't understand that. Then when I read Gail Buckley's book about her mother, Lena Horne, taking her to a Girl Scout thing in Los Angeles when she was out making the movie, and then suggesting that Gail might be happy at the Watts, whatever they call it,
Right.
And Lena finally pointing out that she was Lena Horne, and them changing their mind, and then about 3 months ago, Gail wrote a book review of the book and in the Times. In the course of the book review, she pointed out some little white girl on her father's shoulder in the elevator, and the doors open and the black guy gets in the elevator, and she screams, "Daddy, Daddy, is it going to hurt me?"
Oh my goodness!
And I don't think that I realized that. It must be terribly difficult when I go through life, I don't worry about people thinking differently of me because I'm white or I'm tall or I've got gray hair. But there must be black people who constantly they consider in business and social situations, are they judging me differently because I'm black? And I think that must be dehumanizing all your life.
All of your life. It affects your life. It affects your salary. It affects your position. It affects the way you feel about yourself and your family. And never should race, gender, sexual persuasion, none of that should ever account for anything. We are all human beings. And we have to learn that lesson. Now, we talk about this country being so divided. It's divided, the racial divide is the biggest crack in this whole country. And we haven't really gone much farther than what happened back in the 60s. And you see that when you see a president who's elected, who is asking the first black president of the United States of America to basically show his papers, show the fact that he was born in America. Who is Donald Trump to say that to a sitting president of the United States?
Yeah.
I'd like to see his income taxes. Show us your income tax returns. And it's not just, you feel it, you see it when you're black because you have to. I been in a cab where the cab driver has said to me, you know, you shouldn't get any more suntan. And I said to this particular cab driver, why not? He said, I don't pick up black people. I said, really? Well, then you should stop the car and let me out because I'm black. And by the way, where are you from? Brazil.
God almighty.
Unreal. And these are things that happen over and over. One more story on this, and then we can move on to something more pleasant. But the biggest impact on me, I think, is what happened with my own father. My father was one of the first black ensigns in the United States Navy. He was a polymer chemist for Exxon, one of a few black ones there ever. And he was so smart that he was troubleshooting all around the world for Exxon. He, as a polymer chemist, he was able to analyze refineries and how to refine gasoline from oil. That was his big specialty. He had 10 patents from the STP and STP oil, the plastic and plastic baggies, you name it. There are 10 patents that he and two other people on his team put together, and they're in his name forever. He would fly around the country and troubleshoot. With his assistants and with his team, he could not eat in the same restaurants. He could not stay in the same hotels. He had to sit in the back room while the people were providing the information that he was giving them to the general crowd. In other words, another black hidden figure. And there are so many of them in this country, people who could not step forward because of the color of their skin, which is criminal.
A close friend of mine who coincidentally was the guest on this radio show, Twigs, before you, Bill Lawrence, was the director of diversity recruiting for IBM, and he was the fellow that set this program up for IBM, and I was able, while I was at a college, to place 100 or so students who had never thought to be out of the New York area in positions in Dallas and Raleigh. And so we went through this whole history. And that night I happened to pick up an article in the Times that Major League Baseball is having the same problem with front office people. They have diversity, right, obviously, in the players. And I've been and I sent him the article, and he said it was very much like what he did with IBM. And I've been trying to put him in touch with someone in the commissioner's office and have had no luck so far. Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons I asked you if you know anyone in the commissioner's office.
Yeah.
On to another topic. How did you then, after being on the college station, break into the commercial business, the commercial media?
Well, it
business?
Wasn't really a college station. It was a station in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And it was a regular AM station. And I just got the bug for broadcasting then. I went back home after graduation to Montclair, which, as we discussed earlier, is really a suburb of New York City. And I wrote to people trying to find a way to break into TV in New York. And I saw the name of a guy in the back of Black Enterprise magazine. His name was Gil Griffin, Jr. And he had just been promoted to manager of, or vice president of, management and planning for all of CBS. CBS had the publication division, the music division, and several other divisions back then. And so as a child just out of college, all of what, 21 years old, I picked up the phone, I called his office, and I said I would like to come over and meet with him. And because I was very interested in getting a job in television. Now, thinking back on that, that was a little crazy, but I did it. I just, you know, when you have no fear, you have no fear. He actually said that I could come to his office and talk to him, and he would give me advice, and I did. And when I got to his office, he turned around from his chair, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I fell madly in love. Now, this twists in a couple of directions. Again, being a child of 21, he told me that I should really talk to Ed Joyce, who was then the CBS manager for news. And I went over and talked to him, and Ed Joyce said, listen, kid, you don't start out in New York. You have to go to one of the smaller markets, make your mistakes there, and work your way back. So that was the best advice anybody had ever given me. I ended up moving to Springfield, Illinois, where my father was from, where his mother and brother and my cousins lived. And my uncle got me an interview at the station in Springfield. It was an NBC affiliate. And I got an interview, and then they tried me out on the air, and I got the job. And that was my first job in TV. And I was still 21. It was a very good year. And I stayed there for 3.5 years. And in those days, we were on film. So you had to find your own stories. You would have to shoot your own stories. You would have to come back to the station, process the film from those stories, write your story, put your voice on an audio cart, and then go back into the editing room and splice together the film to tell the story. So invariably, my stories would air, and the film would break on the air, and they'd have to go to commercial break. And it was boot camp, you know, for TV newscasting. And I valued that so much. I learned more there than anywhere. And from there, I went to St. Louis for a year. And then I came back to Montclair. I worked for Channel 13 in New Jersey. And then I got a job at Channel 5 because we had a friend there, a guy named John Miller, who also grew up in Montclair, who's friendly with my brother. And I called him and I said I was looking for work, and he said, come over. And I went to Channel 5. This was before Channel 5 was owned by Rupert Murdoch. Kluge owned it then. And they interviewed me, and I got this job where I was working on a show called Black News 3 days a week, and I was doing weekend weather. So
now,
it was eclectic.
Is he the John Miller who later became part of the administration as in New York as public affairs guy, but it was CBS?
Yes, he is. He's the famous John Miller. He is not John Miller, the publicist who may be Donald Trump.
Okay.
He is the guy. He was Bratton's right-hand man, and yes, he's climbed very far and fast in that particular
field. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Who is Lillian Wilder? I saw that name.
Lillian Wilder was my voice coach, and she was a voice coach to many people. Oprah was one of her clients. Jessica Savage was one of her clients. Many people went through her to learn how to enunciate and to speak in sentences that made sense in a minute 30 story where you could grab the audience. She was terrific, and she wrote a few books on broadcasting and voice lessons and speaking. And then many of us, you know, when we stopped doing that full time for a living, taught the Lillian Wilder method. So I have students that I teach how to speak for broadcasting from time to time.
You spent 20 years with WNEW and the success of the Fox affiliate WNWY as a reporter, weather person, and anchor. We just mentioned weather. How'd you get into weather? And then tell us, from reporting to anchor, how different are the skills?
Oh, they're very different.
And did you have that as the goal throughout your reporting years? Did you want to be an anchor?
Yeah. Well, I started out in Springfield as a reporter and, just got the bug. And once you get the bug, it's very hard to reverse it. It just gets in your skin, and it's exciting. You do something different every day. You're helping people, hopefully. You're reporting on the interesting news of the day. You know, the reporter's the one that gets to jump over the fence, find the news, and bring it back to the people on the other side of the fence. It's exciting. And I always had that in my blood. I just wanted to write and tell people stories. So that was what I always wanted. When I got to Channel 5, the way I got into Channel 5 was I became a reporter for a show that they had called Black News, and it was with Bill McCrary. I think you might remember
him.
He was also an anchor over at Channel 5. And they needed somebody to do weather on weekends, and they asked me if I would try out. I did, and I got that job. Then when the regular weather person left Channel 5, her name was Linda Gellinol. She used to write little smiley faces and did some artwork while she was doing the weather, and that was her gimmick, and she was very popular in New York. But she left. And so they had a cattle call of 200 people, and they ended up using me as their weather person. Well, I was, you know, this reporter who really just wanted to report. But I got that position, and it was lovely because I got to be on the 10 o'clock news. And it was an in-studio job, and it was fun because it was new and it was different. But I longed to tell stories. So one day, you might remember the story of Bernie Goetz, the vigilante subway rider who shot these kids on the subway. One of them was a kid named Daryl Cutey, I believe. And I said, you know what? I want to interview his mother. I wonder how she's feeling about all of this. So I picked up the phone. I found her number. I picked up the phone. I called her. She said she would talk to me. So I told the news director, I really want to do this interview. So he said, no problem. So I went, and I was the only one to interview her right after it happened about her kid who got shot and was paralyzed from this whole incident. And they played it as the first story on the news. And it was an exclusive, and it was, you know, it was great for the station and great for that particular program. And then at the end of the show, I was doing my weather. So after that, I just went into the news director's office and said, listen, I really want to be a reporter again. Please, can I? And so they decided to get a real weather person to do the weather, and they let me report. So I did that for a few years, and a show was started called Good Day New York. And the original team was it wasn't Jim Ryan. It was a woman named Marion Atwal Watson and some other guy whose name I can't remember. And they were on for a few months, and they changed the anchors, and Jim Ryan became one of them. Lynn Brown, I believe, became one of them. Julie Golden did the weather, and a woman named Barbara Laskin, who's a good friend of mine, did the news. She was the newsreader. Well, around that same time, this is another way of telling this story. My mother was dying of cancer, and she said to me, what's the one thing that you want that you haven't done in your life? And I said, I really want to be an anchor, Mom. I really want to be an anchor. And she died in February on Valentine's Day. The following December 10th, I was called into the office, and they said, we're going to let you anchor the news on Channel 5 on Good Day New York. You're going to start on December 15th. I was excited, and my friend Barbara Laskin was told that she was being fired, that I was not happy about, and she decided to leave a day earlier, December 14th. So on December 14th, I got my first anchoring job, and that was also my birthday, the first one since my mother's death and that conversation.
Wow. Was Steve McFarlane for Channel 5?
Yes. He was there later. I think he was. He was working on a different show there Current Affair, I believe.
Yes, Steve did. Steve's been a guest, and he's also from my old neighborhood. And another coincidence, the fellow that's on next week, Chick Donahue, when he was younger, he went hitching with some friends, and and a man allowed them to stay in a cabin on his dairy farm outside of Rhinebeck, New York, and the fellow had the son who they thought was rather quiet and rather strange. And according to the story, and I wasn't there, so I can't swear totally for the accuracy, the father tried to crawl into bed that night with my friend, who rebuffed him and pushed him out. And they left. And the father was Mr. Bernard Goetz Sr. And the strange young lad was young Bernard. So that was so awful that there was obviously something a little off or overreacting with this fellow, and he was turned into a hero by the loonies on the right, as a tragic hero and as a hero, you know, something should be persecuted on someone on the left, and he should have been put into a hospital. He should
absolutely
not have become
right.
that polarizing figure.
But it's, you know, people see the small man fighting back against the scary black kids. And again, it's perception. Everything that we do in life has to do with perception, the way we were brought up, the way we were socialized, you know, who our peers were, what our mores and values were. Those things don't shift that much in a given lifetime. And that's why we still have the scars of the Civil War. Those things have been passed along from generation to generation. If you look at television, most of what you see is the perpetrators in the news are black. But it's not because they're black. It's because they are socioeconomically deprived. They are the lower class. Not every black person is. I never, you know, grew up with anybody who lived in a ghetto or was in jail or was a criminal. You know, that's not who all black people are. But unfortunately, if you don't have many black friends, if you don't know the ways of the world, if you're not that sophisticated, you think when you see a black person, I need to be afraid because that person's here to rob me or to hurt me. And that has got to change.
Yeah.
And that's why I think also a lot of people had problems with Barack Obama, because Obama, you know, didn't fit that mold. He wasn't the ghetto kid in a gang or the drug dealer. He wasn't that. He was a part of what most of the people that I grew up with were, which is that great black middle class that nobody likes to talk about.
But the bigoted people still found a way to say he only got to Harvard for affirmative action. He was dumb. He only got to law review. He only did this. He only did that. And they were trying to drag him down to the ghetto kid that you're talking about. You know,
exactly, because that's their perception. That's the box that they put all black people in. And that's why, you know, Trump is one of the progenitors of that. I mean, he's the one who said he didn't really go to Harvard. How did he get there? And there's so many people who just don't trust him, who did not, that he had to be Muslim. He had to cheat to get there, right? He couldn't have had good grades. He couldn't have been smart because he's black. And they won't ever feel that way, because that's the way they were raised to think. And that, again, do you think Donald Trump is ever going to change? Never. And nor will the people who identify with him and his values.
But some people break out of the box. There were many people from my old neighborhood that were predisposed to be bigoted, who when they got older, they were just the opposite. They were just they broke out of the box. Others didn't.
Right. And that's, again, that's about life circumstances, right? If you go into a foxhole, one guy's black, one guy's white, the black guy saves the white guy's life. The white guy is one of those white guys who hated all black people. His perception of black people will change. You know, those life experiences also change you.
Obviously, a Fox National outlet, Fox News, has been much – and recent news with the sexual harassment lawsuits and the firings. Did you ever see such goings on at the local channel? And do you have any comments on the overall stories?
I do have comments on it, but first of all, local, it was very different. We were not an arm of, and I hate to say this, but with Roger Ailes, it was an arm of the Republican Party. I mean, he wrote about that when he was working for Nixon. He wanted to have a network that catered to the Republican Party. He was the head of the Republican Party at one time. It's quite interesting how Rupert Murdoch was able to do that, to change the FCC laws. You remember, there was a time when I was a journalist at Channel 5, and if you had one person on saying something about for the Democratic Party, you had to have a counterpoint on the Republican side. You know, you couldn't not have a balanced newscast, or you'd be called to question, and your license could be affected.
And they also had to sell the New York Post to buy Channel 5, and it was
exactly.
Only later that they were able to buy the Post back under an exemption.
Rupert Murdoch bought his way into so many law changes. I think this was during the Reagan administration. And now who's his best friend? Donald Trump. He just revealed that he talks to him every day. So when Donald Trump goes on the air and says Fox and Friends is the best show on television, you know, you got to wonder, is this state-sponsored television now? Seriously, this is not a democracy. This is not how a democracy works.
Well, it's the only one he knows how to watch anyhow, so it would have to be
That's
the best
true.
To him.
That's true. Now, back to some of the sexism and all that. That's totally, it's everywhere. It's in every industry. You know, it's in every corporation because boys will be boys and girls will be girls. However, your bosses are not supposed to give you an ultimatum, this or that. They and your boss should not be hitting on you. I mean, that's taboo. Your coworkers, it's a part of what happens in a work environment. Sadly or not, it is. And I know people who supposedly got their jobs because they did this or that. That's, you know, again, that's classic. You hear that in a lot of TV shops, radio shops, and most of corporate America. It is prevalent. I don't see how that changes so quickly. I think what happened, though, at Fox was that apparently there was this culture of sexual harassment and racism. And that part is frightening. Because, again, back in the old days, if the FCC saw that, you could lose your license. And, in fact, they are being investigated now for breaking rules and laws.
Did then move to co-anchor on WPIX Channel 11's morning news for over 5 years. How different was that role from your previous anchoring on WYNY?
When I was at Channel 5, I was the news anchor. When I was at Channel 11, I was brought over there to start a show similar to the one that I had left at Channel 5 to Good Day New York. And Karen Scott was the wonderful news director at the time, and it was terrific. It was the WB11 morning news show. It was exciting. It was a startup. We got a lot of press. We won Emmys. It was, you know, the little engine that could, and we did. And it was a great time. I was one of the, I guess I was probably the most senior person there. I was the oldest, probably in my mid or late 30s, early 40s. So I was treated a little differently because, you know, the producers to me were kids. They were 28, 24, 25. And they kind of, you know, I think they felt threatened that I understood news, and it was kind of new to some of them, not all of them. When 9/11 happened, we were just going off the air, and we all were in the newsroom, and I saw, you know, this hole in a building that CNN was reporting, and I said, that's a no-fly area. It's the World Trade Center. We need to go back on the air. This is a major story, and it's happening right here. And my executive producer at the time, a 30-year-old whose first job as an executive producer on a show like this was that particular job, said, you're crazy. Go to your office. It's not a story. You don't know what you're talking about. So instead of going to my office, I called my news director, who was upstairs at the time, in a meeting. She came downstairs. We went live every day for hours and hours and hours for the biggest, most horrific story of our lifetime. And for that, I got very harshly punished by this guy. He made my life miserable because I went over his head to make sure we got on the air with this story of 9/11. So we have all kinds of issues, you know, and it's politics played everywhere.
One of Channel 11's current street reporters and one of the best-known street reporters in New York has briefly been on the show, McGee Hickey. Her brother is a novelist. He's an ex police officer, and he's written books about mystery. Frank Hickey, he's been my guest, and the McGee's come on to talk with him and about him.
Yeah, she's terrific. She's one of my dear friends. And I know him as well. I've been to a few of his birthday parties and book parties. He's prolific. He's doing quite well.
either their grandfather or their great grandfather laid some of the original concrete at Ebbets Field, and in Brooklyn. And and Frank's been an investigative for the two DA's office in Manhattan and in Queens. He's been on a LAPD when Bratton was there. He was he was a private investigator in Southeast Asia, and and he goes to to the monthly meeting that I attend in Yonkers called the Narrowbacks, where he talks about his books. So he's an interesting fellow. He's a nice fellow.
Yeah, very nice fellow. And she's amazing. She's one of the longest lasting reporters on the air in New York TV. I think she's worked at every station, and she just keeps resurfacing. God bless her. She is an amazing person.
Do you know who just became one of my Facebook friends?
Who's
Gabe
that?
Gabe Pressman.
Oh, he is. Talk about an icon. I do Inner Circle every year, and he's a part of it. I mean, he's such an icon. There's nobody like him. And he's got a job for life. So what could be better, right?
And Marvin Scott's been around for years, too.
He's been around for years, too. Yeah.
And then you went off TV. That must have been very different. Tell us about that.
Court TV was great. There was a guy there running it at the time named Henry Schleif. Henry was probably one of the best bosses I have ever had. He was just fair, smart. He was creative. He didn't take any BS. He just his instincts drove him very far in the industry. I believe he's over at another cable station right now, Discovery, doing masterful things there. But he's a giant in the industry, and he made the work environment pleasurable, interesting, and smart. I mean, there were a lot of lawyers working there, and they made courts look interesting for TV viewers. Really hard to do, because a lot of courtroom activity isn't interesting, as you probably know.
While you're doing Court TV, you also moved into radio, co-hosting a syndicated talk show with former Newsday columnist Dallas Hennigan. How did you get into that, and how different was that for you?
Well, when I stopped working at Channel 11, Joan Hamburg asked me to fill in for her at WOR Radio, and I did. And her producer became the production manager, I believe it was, over there, and they asked me to stay. And they said, do you want to do your own show with a co-host? And I said, yeah. And they said, we're going to try you out with a few people. And Ellis was one of the people. And we had instant chemistry. We became instant friends, and we are to this day. He's brilliant, smart, likable, fun. And he's a good person. That was a great work experience, I have to say. So I was doing that at the same time I was doing this show called Hollywood Heat over at Court TV, and I had decided to get a license in real estate. So I was doing real estate, too. I had those three revenue streams coming in, which was, you know, in your 50s, it didn't suck. It was pretty darn good. But one by one, those things shifted and changed, and then I'm still doing real estate, and I'm still doing media, and life is still good.
Didn't he move to New Orleans, Ellis?
No, he was from there, and his family's there.
Okay,
but he lives in Manhattan.
I used to communicate with him hardly at all by email when he was with Newsday. Just send him a note on a column every now and then. That radio experience led to fill in work on the show with Water Distribution, doing John Batchelor's WABC nighttime.
Was an incredible experience. That was different because WABC was different from WOR. WOR was a Buckley family corporation, so it was a family run, owned and operated, and he was the boss, and you know, his daughter was a salesperson there. And it was a small, enclosed environment, and everybody knew everybody else. People were friendly, And it was just a, it was a sweet place to work. Channel WABC was bigger, larger, and I didn't know many of the people there, but I knew John Batchelor, and I went on his radio show, and then they asked me to fill in for him when he was away. And that experience was terrific because it's an intellectual show, and you get to really talk to people in depth. It's not superficial. And some of the people were, you know, people who were regulars who spoke with him a lot. And it was a learning experience, and I just, that was one of my finest hours, having been given the privilege of sitting in for the great John Batchelor. He is one of a kind, I think.
He had this show with Paul Alexander, and there was Paul was more liberal. He had written he was writing the book about John McCain, and Batchelor had this. They cut the show back to weekend, and then when 9/11 came, bang, they were back on full time, and then eventually Paul left the show, and it became totally Batchelor. He's another person who I used to email back and forth at times. He has the same people. It's a more conservative bent, but it's an intellectual conservative bent.
Yes,
it's not
there's a difference, right? There's
not
a difference between radical right and radical left and centrists. And I think the world is more centrist. I think that he encapsulates what's good about the voice of the center right people. And we need more of that. You know, and most of my Republican friends, not all of them, most of my Republican friends in New York are like him. They're Rockefeller Republicans, and they're smart, and they read, and they watch things, and they know what's right, and they know what's wrong. They're not radical. And the same can be said of some people that are on the very far left. We don't live, you know, on the extremes. Most of us live our lives in the center, and that's the way it should be.
But even the more traditional conservatives, to work further to the right, but the intelligent, thoughtful ones like William Buckley and George Will,
yes.
I mean, they are so different than the Limbos and the Hannitys and the knee-jerk ones who are not intellectuals. You know,
but isn't that interesting, though, that you have a Fox News channel, and you have some of these syndicated radio shows where these guys get millions and millions and millions of dollars, and some, there were some over at WOR as well, to spew venom, to spew hate, to spew, to divide us. That is, that has brought our country to the brink. That has given us a Donald Trump as president. This has got to be changed, I think. Otherwise, we're going to walk down this road, and it's not going to be an easy one for our country, because we will go farther apart. We will have more Donald Trumps. We will have fewer people in the center, because, you know, one side attracts the opposite side, and it's all vitriol and hate, and that is not a way to live. Divided we fall.
I want to bring you back to this as I do want to finish your history first, because the real estate work that you mentioned didn't pull you apart from media. You began blogging for the Huffington Post. You became a media trainer, and you started your present work for the WNBC TV Nightly News. To take them one at a time, how did you get into blogging and then get to the Huffington Post?
Well, I've always been a writer. In fact, after I left the WB, I started writing a book on broadcasting. And I shopped it around, and everybody said you have to have a platform. And I'm thinking, what's a platform? Something to stand on. But you have to have other ways to communicate. And so I started blogging, which is normal because I've been blogging before. I have a website called the LynnWhiteSite.com where I blog. And I also am very, as you can see, you're a Facebook friend of mine, I'm very active on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm vocal. I speak my mind. I don't hold back. People hate me or they tolerate me. I just cannot be someone who sits back idly and lets things happen that are not helping the United States of America. And I see so much of that in a given day, and I think we all do. And we have got to say enough. I mean, there's a reason there's a movement called the resistance. Resist this hate, this division. It is not going to do us well. We have to get along. We have to get along with each other, and we've got to figure out how to do that before it's too late.
You mentioned your website. That's www.lynnwhiteside.com. And Lynn Whiteside is one word, L-Y-N-N-E, W-H-I-T-E-S-I-T-E, www.lynnwhiteside.com. I noticed that your blogs there, though, they end on October of last year. Have you given up blogging on your own site?
No, I haven't. I just I think I need to update that. I've been pretty busy. I'm working on a new show that I'm not really allowed to talk about yet, but it is about politics and bringing people together in politics. So I kind of shied away from that for a little bit, and I blogged on my Facebook site. I've been doing a lot of real estate recently with some pretty interesting clients. So I've been busy, and I'm still writing this book. So it's just when you do so many things, something's going to get pushed to the side for a little bit, and was blogging on my site. But I'll be back.
I know that. Now, please describe the work that you do as a media trainer.
Well, as I said, I have a few students that I've worked with, teach them how to project on the air. I also do corporate clients who just want to be more effective when they're giving talks or lectures, and I do that a lot too, which is it's interesting. I like to see my students progress to the point where they feel very confident about public speaking. So a lot of people don't. And a lot of people have issues with projecting, with enunciation, and it's a very interesting skill to have in today's times, when we're all over social media.
Is this what you mean by media grooming?
Yes.
Okay. Now, to your most
If you want to do a YouTube page, right, and you want to make it sing and make it sizzle and really be effective in getting your message across, you come to me and I'll show you how to do that.
Okay. And now to your most present publicly recognizable work as an online personality for 7 years at WNBC-TV. You have described as a contributing political pundit. Would you flesh out that role for us?
Yes.
What does it mean?
That's a good question, too. I just basically gave my views on different issues in the news. So it was on Cozy TV, which is no longer, and there was a moderator. It was usually Chuck Scarborough in the beginning for the first few years, and there were three other commentators around him. I was one of the three, and I was the liberal voice. Judy Licht was the conservative voice, and there was another person there who was either liberal or very conservative, and we all gave our opinions on whatever the topic of the day was. And that was great, and you can go to YouTube, and they're all there, all of our segments. But Judy and I will be back. She's working on me with this project that I just alluded to, and we will be back, and I will let you know when that is.
In years gone by, there have been a number of well-known commentators, mainly on CBS, it seems, Eric Severide, Andy Rooney, and Charles Osgood, to name a few. Do you see this as the role you want to continue it for the rest of your career?
Yes, I do. I will never stop being a broadcaster. I will always. I think the medium is changing, and I think the ways to get your voice, your opinion out there are different. There are more ways than ever before, and you can do it on your own. You don't have to sit in a studio, as you know, in a corporate office in Midtown to be able to get your voice heard. And I think it's important for people who have always been journalists at heart to do that. That's a very precious part of what our sense of purpose is. You know that in writing and getting out messages to people, teaching people, helping people. All of that is a big part of life's purpose, and that's a part of my life's purpose that I hope I never lose.
you alluded earlier to the current political situation. To one thing that scares me, and it seems to scare many people, is the whole idea of the fake news and the media is the enemy of the public rather than people that we either agree with or we disagree with. I mean, for years growing up, there was the very liberal New York Post. There was the very conservative Daily News. They've gone the other way now. But no one said that they lied or that they had people said, I don't believe them or I don't agree with them. But there was never – they were the enemy of the public, and I don't know –
Sounds like we're in Russia. That's what Putin would do, although he murders journalists as well, you know, and most dictators do. This is a whole new thing that's coming from a whole different kind of presidency, one that you haven't seen before, I have never seen before, and I hope we never see again in this country. It defies what democracy is, First Amendment rights. You are – allowed to speak and say what you please without getting punished or treated like you are of no value and you are nothing but lies. That message is a very damning message to anybody who believes in freedom and democracy and the press.
They might have said things like this before. Like, obviously, there were many people that hated the New York Times. My father preferred the New York Herald Tribune that was more Rockefeller Republican. But I have never seen people making speeches and thousands or hundreds of people perhaps cheering them when they talked about fake news. And number one, how is he able to excite this hatred of the liberal press? And what can we do to recover the balance that we used to have?
I think 2018, you've got to vote your conscience and have a balance. First of all, let's start with Congress. Let's get it balanced again. You know, this is, you can't have somebody who wants to be a dictator, who sees himself as a Putinesque figure, without a checks and balance system around him. You have to get Democrats into office or moderate Republicans who don't answer to their puppeteers, you know, before they make a choice or a vote. I think that's critical. I think that's the number one thing. The scary thing about Donald Trump and why he gets away with this is because people have known him for years as a television character, so they believe they can trust him. This is his, you know, the people who support him. And the fact is that whatever he says to those who follow him, he's God. And it's like a chant, a march. You've never seen anything like it. It's like he's the master puppeteer and they're the puppets, the Pied Piper. It's not a way to govern, and it's not a way to have a democracy. We have got to fix what's broken. He is not the answer.
The difficulty with 2018, though, is this severely gerrymandered state of our congressional district where there are,
amen,
there are safe Democratic seats, there are more safe Republican seats, and there are very few really contested seats. Republicans really have to do something stupid to file it up for themselves. They may, but they, you know, but some of them won't.
I agree with that, but I think that's why 2018 is important, to at least bring some new faces, new energy in there and fix again some of these things that are horribly broken. And let's look at the Electoral College. Why is that still here?
Among all your other work, you mentioned this, the book you're writing on broadcasting. Without giving more than you'd like to, what's the thrust of the book? Is the working title, or do you have a target date?
I have a working title, Confessions of a Recovering Anchor Woman.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. And no target date?
No target date. No publisher yet. So
okay.
If you know people, please send them my way. I need help.
That's why God made CreateSpace, Amazon publishing on demand site.
Yes.
What else in addition to the new projects and the book, what else is next for you?
Last year at my age, I had a miracle happen. I got married for the second time, having been not married for almost 17 or 18 years. So I'm enjoying life right now with my husband and my career, but my husband comes first. It's all about love. That's what makes the world happy, and that's what I was blessed with later in life.
That's what makes the world go round.
That's right.
As I say. We covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Lynn White?
Look for the book, look for our new TV show, and follow us on Twitter or follow me on Twitter. Please contact me at my website, lynnwhitesite.com, or on Facebook, and continue to listen to this fabulous show. What a great interviewer you are. People can take lessons.
Thank you very much. Oh, do you have any platform for the news, the show, or do you have any target date?
No. No,
okay.
We don't. And I'm told not to talk about it. So it'll be done, and you'll definitely know about it. I will contact you.
Thank you very much, Lynn. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure indeed. Have a great night.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com and publish the daily paper mentioned above. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of previous shows, and I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Chick Donahue. And we'll take it off with the New York song. East side, west side. This was the theme song of the weekly Horn and Hearts radio show when I was very young. Fantastic. On the sidewalks of Good night, Lynn. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And good night, everybody.